Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I'm a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to Mark Wheeler about one of the best films from the 1970s, William Friedkin's Sorcerer, a remake of Wages of Fear, which in some ways outdoes its original classic, though that original is. If you enjoy the episode, please remember to use social media to spread the word, leave a review, like, and do all those things that make it possible for us to reach a wider audience. And before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation. I remember the first time I saw Sorcerer. Was very late, very, very late. It was like 4 or 5 years ago, and it was at the Venice Film Festival, and William Friedkin was receiving like a Lifetime Achievement Award, and he introduced the film. Friedkin being Friedkin, they kind of had to say at some point, you know, we really need to get the film.
Because
he was one of the funniest, most entertaining sort of guys and most loquacious. He was amazing. What was your first experience with the film?
Well, I was trying to work this one out, and interestingly enough, I think I saw the bizarre international cut of it once on television when I was about 12. But it's only it came out quite shortly after because the film was obviously a financial disaster. And I assume they must have sold it to British television in that cut, because I remember my dad watching it. I mean, he was a big fan of, obviously, the original Clouseau film, The Wages of Fear. And he just was tut-tutting at everything, because we'd seen The French Connection, and it was just like, how did this guy go from that to this, you know? And it had, obviously, you know, the rope bridge sequence and several of the action sequence, but they completely butchered it and removed all the original kind of 40 minutes of it, which is all the backstories, which get into obviously the Paul Vernier, you know, the world's worst village. And I think there was an occasional bit of Scheider's, you know, the Roy Scheider bank, the church robbery scene was cut into, and maybe a bit of the French fraudster, but I think pretty much everything else had gone, basically. And then it was one of these kind of weird lost films for years. And obviously, there'd always been The French Connection and The Exorcist. And he'd obviously also made To Live and Die in LA. And then he'd had a tumultuous career, to put it mildly, even before and after Sorcerer. But and then it came out on DVD, I think, about 15 years ago. And not a very good copy, but I managed to get hold of a copy internationally because I, at that point, had an international DVD broadcasting kit. And I watched it online, and it was like, blimey, this is actually a really good film. And it actually stands up compared to The Wages of Fear, which is obviously an excellent film as well. And how did this kind of situation occur, that this film had ended up in such kind of a disaster? And because it was all at the same time, I think, when the Peter Biskin book of Easy Riders Raging Bulls came out, and it had quite a substantive amount of material on Friedkin, and obviously the disaster that befell the production, and then the outcome of the Sorcerer as being, you know, the film that was blown away by Star Wars, essentially. So that's kind of my background to it. And then I tried for several years to actually put forward a kind of BFI monograph idea, which there was no bit on. And then I, bizarre enough, just out of apropos of nothing, a publishing company, an American company, was asking for a proposal. So I thought, well, why not stick it in? And they bit on it. So there you go, you know. So.
Brilliant, brilliant, and well done. And I mean, it's a book that deserves, sorry, it's a film that deserves a lot of attention. Your book obviously deserves a lot of attention as well. So, I definitely had read about it in the Biskin book. This is Peter Biskin's Easy Riders, Raging Bulls. I honestly think there's a book to be written. I have no animus against Peter Biskin, but I think that there is a counter book to be written because I think his book is very dodgy in terms of sort of he never lets a good story go verified.
What is that? It's a gossipy book, obviously. There's obviously a lot about the loves and lives of these auteur directors, including Friedkin and Coppola particularly. And they were very critical of it, obviously, that Friedkin said it was written, you know, he only interviewed ex-girlfriends who had it in for him, basically. And there's also, I think Paul Schrader also, there was a documentary that was produced off the back of that film, a book, and they had kind of extended interviews, and Schrader basically said that Biskin had a thesis that he just was relentlessly going to pursue, that everybody was great in the first part of the 70s, and they kind of went berserk, took loads of drugs, which is not untrue in some of it, obviously, and they're films that sort of morphed into these elephantine-like productions, and basically they lost control of it, that, and, you know, we blew it, you know, in the words of Easy Rider, was kind of his position. And Schrader said, well, look, I'm making what I consider to be more interesting films now than I was making in the 1970s. Your thesis doesn't work, but he had a thesis which it became kind of the general truism of that whole idea that, you know, it was this golden period. And it was I think it was a golden period because there was lots of great films being made, and it was obviously interesting times in terms of the commercial direction of Hollywood at that time as well. And you had opportunities in the system which previously hadn't occurred, and obviously people were, the new Hollywood arrived. But I do agree with you in terms of the notion that the Biskin book can have an equally a counter narrative to it as well. I think it's Biskin's best book because I've read some of his other stuff, which is very choppy, basically. And the one he did about all the Tarantino generation, I thought was just very, very poor as well, because he didn't really have an angle on that. At least he had an angle on the Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, you know.
Yeah, and weirdly, a huge missed opportunity, because the one on the Tarantino thing is very much the story of Harvey Weinstein, and it's kind of almost celebrating their behavior. It's like, oh, look at the bad boys go, you know. And you know, obviously there's no stuff about but you are sort of thinking, you're digging around
like as a journalist, and you didn't get that story? I mean,
I think there was an amalgam around Harvey Weinstein. I'm not going to go too far down that rabbit hole, but how various directors, including Tarantino himself, didn't know what Weinstein was up to always seems beyond me. But, you know, again, I know Hollywood always works on the bottom line, which, you know, Friedkin said the notion is that a success has 1,000 fathers, a failure has none. And when Weinstein was making money for Hollywood, it worked in that respect, that lots of people owed him lots of situations. Once he started losing money and started losing his power base, then it's interesting how quickly it all fell apart, really, to me. But I know that's a very kind of economic determinist position, but I mean, I know Me Too came out in the whole process, but there was also a situation that's the kind of unsaid narrative also I had with Weinstein as well. His film simply stopped making money, you know, and start making. And, you know, it's always that question between art and commerce, isn't it, in Hollywood as well. So, and if you can get the balance right, like Friedkin did, certainly with The French Connection and even more with The Exorcist, you are therefore in a position of apparent invulnerability, but then, of course, it all crashed and burned around Sorcerer. So, and he never quite was able to get back to that ascendancy he once had, you know, after Sorcerer. So that was the other interesting thing to me, but how his career had this, you know, spectacular kind of rise in the early 70s. He wins the Best Director Oscar, obviously the great success of The Exorcist in terms of its financial clout. And then this film comes about and it seems to, there doesn't seem to be any kind of real explanation of his financial collapse, basically. And obviously, I think he'd obviously done the classic thing of biting the hand that had fed him as well. Because when I looked into the kind of production history, neither studio really wanted to make Sorcerer. That was the other factor. And he had this thing of getting two studios involved, you know, so...
Well, yes, that sort of turns into a problem for him because they can sort of shift the blame from one to the other without either of them sort of wanting to be left holding the sort of the bucket of shame.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was bizarre. I was rereading again because there was this odd kind of distribution company that Paramount and Universal had internationally, certainly in Europe, called CIC, which is a Cinema International Corporation. And actually the film, because Friedkin eventually had to find out who owned the film about 10, 15 years ago now, he had to go into a court case because he couldn't be shown. Suddenly it was out of circulation. And he found out it was owned by this shell company that Paramount and Universal had used in the 70s and 80s as their major distribution company in Europe. So again, this was that whole question about nobody wanting to take blame, you're right, is another factor in this situation, you know. And his main kind of advocate in this situation, Charles de Bluthorn, had also died subsequently as well. And people like Lou Wasserman, Sid Sheinberg and Barry Diller and Ned Tannen really didn't want that film. You know, it's interesting because he actually negotiated independently this great financial deal for himself after the French Connection with Jules Stein, who was the chairman of MCA, the old guy who ran it initially. So both Wasserman and I think Sheinberg's noses were significantly put out of joint that this upstart director had managed to circumvent them basically as well.
Let's go because we've started a little bit back to front. We're talking about the sort of the reception of the film and but that's how we've received it so far. There's been this butchered version that you saw. I actually saw the best version in a sense, but that was a version that was unavailable for many years. But let's go back to the beginning of Friedkin and his career. He's not coming out of film school like Lucas and Coppola. He's not coming out of Corman like Scorsese, Jonathan Demme.
Well, and Coppola and Bogdanovich as well. So, you know,
he's really going from directly from school, you know, as you say in your book, to the sort of to the mailroom of a TV studio, and then kind of making a career for himself. It's a kind of an alternative route.
It's an interesting route because, firstly, he obviously gets into this work for this television station out of Chicago. First off, he's from Chicago. And as you say, worked through the mailroom. He then manages to, by the age of his early 20s, he's done thousands of hours of direction of television programs, all types of television programs, from what I can tell. I mean, obviously dramas as well. And he is very influenced by, I suppose, there was that TV generation of filmmakers like Sidney Lumet, particularly John Frankenheimer, who I think became quite a hero to Friedkin and a mentor in some respects. And there's a kind of baton that's passed, actually, if you look at it, between Frankenheimer to Friedkin, then Friedkin to Spielberg, actually, who all come out of a TV route. And then, obviously, he becomes very much best known as a documentarian. He makes this very famous documentary on for Chicago TV about the People versus Paul Crump, which obviously is this guy's on death row that he, I mean, Coppola said, you know, that was one of the great films of all time because it actually got someone, who'd been convicted actually off, basically, as well. And on the basis of that, he becomes, his documentarian side takes him into Hollywood, basically. He goes to work for a character called David Wolper. And Wolper makes lots of documentaries for television. And at Wolper, he meets Waylon Green, who will be the screenwriter, and also Bud Smith, who becomes one of his kind of major collaborators, his main editor and second unit director and those kind of associate producer. And apropos out of that also, then he gets the attention of, I can't remember the name of the guy, he was Hitchcock's television producer. And he makes the last ever Hitchcock TV series program.
Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
Alfred Hitchcock Presents, yeah. And this is, you know, again, you may have heard the tale that he famously was making the film and making the TV program. Hitchcock shows up and he says Hitchcock then put out his hand like a sort of dead sort of duck or something, and expecting him to, I don't know, like to kiss it or something, I don't know, like a pope or something, and he shakes it, and then Hitchcock, he thinks that Hitchcock's going to have this great insight, and says, then Hitchcock says to him, "Our directors normally wear ties, Mr. Friedkin," and then just walks off. So, and then Friedkin supposedly had his revenge when he was getting all the awards for French Connection, when he showed up with a snapped bow tie and went up to Hitchcock and said, "Look, do you remember this Hitch and did this through this bow tie as well?" So he comes out of that. Yeah, that, and it's an interesting generation. He's sort of generationally, you know, part of the, you know, the kind of TV directors, but he's also pre the movie brat, as it were. I mean, Coppola, I suppose, and Bogdanovich are his main contemporaries, if you look at it kind of, just in terms of where they all actually stand in terms of their age and things like that as well.
Yeah, Arthur Penn is a little bit behind him in Frankenheimer as well.
Cause... Well, Arthur Penn was another. Well, Arthur Penn was a TV director who'd made The Left-Handed Gun before. In the late 50s, and also he was also a very famous sort of New York Broadway director as well before he'd done Bonnie and Clyde. Yeah. So, but I mean, I suppose there's Lumet, Frankenheimer, Penn, and also there's Franklin J. Schaffner and Robert Mulligan, who were they were considered to be the kind of the figures who came out of that New York TV drama kind of process, who'd made the original 12 Angry Men and all that kind of thing as well on TV before it went to film and things like that.
Yeah, frequently live, so they learned blocking on the hoof, you know.
Well, I think, well, this happened with Friedkin as well, where he learned a lot off the hoof, making it for live Chicago television, from what I can tell.
So he goes to the movies. It takes him a while to crack it, though. I mean, he has sort of a fair number of credits to his name, films like The Birthday Party, which I there's a lot to admire, but I mean, Pinter being Pinter, it's not necessarily a film you would love.
Well, his first four films are financially negligible, it has to be said. I mean, but he did learn a lot. He learned a lot. He made the original film was with Sonny and Cher, Good Times. And then he moved on, which he basically said he just made on the hoof, basically, as well. He made a film called, I've never seen, called The Night of the Raided Minskies, which was... Right.
Jason Robards.
Jason Robards and Norman Wisdom, I think, was in it as well. And Britt Edwards. It's got a kind of eclectic cast. And that was more of a kind of Norman Lear production. that Friedkin kind of was the director on, but was not really in control of. And he said he was too young to make such a big production because it was quite, so it was obviously a kind of historical production. Then he makes The Birthday Party, which is an interesting sojourn. He's actually making that in Worthing and with Robert Shaw and people like that, you know. And then he ultimately makes The Boys in the Band, which is a kind of the first sort of Hollywood film about homosexuality. Which, of course, was something later on in his career would also emerge, of course, with the, you know, the Al Pacino film, you know, Cruising as well. And so he up to, as you say, I suppose you can, it's a bit like Coppola in that respect, because Coppola, if you look at, again, his early films, up to really, I suppose, The Rain People, he's making, he comes out of Roger Corman, as we know. He makes the You're a Big Boy Now, which is his kind of thesis film for, and he also he makes the bizarre enough Finian's Rainbow, which he meets George Lucas on as well. And they're kind of trying to make a voice for themselves, I think, him and Coppola and whatever. And it takes for both of them to really their fifth film in terms of being directors to actually find something distinctive. And what Friedkin realizes, that he needs to make something that's more business than show, as it were, and less artsy and esoteric. Otherwise, he's just going to be marginalized. And supposedly, he was going out with Howard Hawks' daughter at the time. And Howard Hawks said, "You need to make a film that has a chase in it." So, and the fact was, he also realized from watching the film Z, however it's pronounced, the Costa Gavras film, that he could actually fuse together a kind of action narrative with a documentarian style. And this seems to be where the penny drops for Friedkin in terms of a cinematic style, I would say.
Just using that documentary immediacy that he's learned in Chicago and putting it into a Hollywood genre.
Yeah, well, he redefines the whole kind of cop procedure film with The French Connection. And supposedly threw out the book, and he, again, the Pinter thing helps him as well, because he likes the dialogue that Popeye Doyle, or what's the real name, I can't remember, anyway, when he meets Grosso and the real Popeye Doyle, they have this kind of bizarre pick your feet in Poughkeepsie thing, which he has a kind of Pinterest kind of quality to it. You know, certainly the opening sequence where they're beating up the black guy and they're kind of having this weird interrogation thing to completely put the guy off beam and whatever, has a kind of Pinterest kind of quality to it. And also he develops a kind of style which also has a very kinetic kind of narrative editorial pace to it as well, which, of course, is most explicitly shown in the very famous car chase where Popeye Doyle is chasing, you know, the elevated train. But it's also shown in the kind of cat and mouse stuff that's going on between Gene Hackman's character and the Fernando Rey, you know, the villain Alan Charnier, when they're going around the New York streets and things like that. And, you know, and when he loses him on the underground as well, on the subway, you know. So, what I think Friedkin learns is to cut to the bone as well, because, again, if you look at the DVD, there's a number of extra sequences that really don't add anything narratively. Might have been more character-based, because I think Hackman got a bit peeved about that, although he won the best Oscar for actor in it. But Friedkin, you know, said, no, we've got to be relentless in this. You can't muck around or whatever. So that kind of gave him that, you know, that incredible pace to his films as well.
Yeah, that thing that you said in terms of your book, it reminds me, you know, that idea of the interest that he has in people doing things, like how the mechanics of action. How does this work? How do a group of people? So it's sort of you know, character is action, as I think you quote F. Scott Fitzgerald. And you see that in The Exorcist as well, in terms of the most interesting thing is when they're trying to diagnose the child, and then the actual minutiae of what does an exorcist look like? What do you do? What do you wear? What is the order of things? You know, I'm always a little disappointed. The actual exorcist isn't a bit longer, because I always feel that it's a bit too short for me in the in the film?
Well, I know it's considered to be a Mark Kermode's favourite film and everything like that. I mean, for me, I always thought The Exorcist is a very well-made film. I have seen it. I'd seen it once with an audience years ago on Halloween, and it did shock people. But it's never, to me, it was as much as William Peter Blatty's thing as it was Friedkin's. I mean, it's brilliantly made by Friedkin. I'm not going to deny that. But and there are some, you know, auteural themes, but you've also got to think about it comes from Blatty's book as well. And the other factor is that I think, as you say, this kind of thing, what Friedkin is most interested in is, you know, that whole stuff where they're trying to diagnose her. And they put the sequence he said that most people took grave offence to was that sequence where she has to have the medical examination and she has the stuff poured into her body and things like that as well. And again, if you think of the French Connection, there's a whole bit where they completely demolished the car to try and find the heroin. Now, that supposedly was based on a true story. And the guy who was the mechanic was the true mechanic. From it always struck me as a bit bizarre that you thought the first place they would look at how would be the rocker panels, you know, because you know it's a bit, you go, well, surely you'd have looked at that bit first before distributing the whole, taking the whole engine apart and taking the oil away and whatever. That you know, it seemed fairly obvious that it would stick them just by the door panel, basically. But anyway, go ahead, yeah.
But it's parodied in one of the Naked Guns, or it might be Police Squad, where they take apart an entire car and then they find it in the glove compartment.
Exactly. I mean, but of course, also the French Connection, there's bits of The Wire, if you watch The Wire, that you can pick up on. Again, I mean, the whole procedural thing. And it's even a sequence where, Popeye Doyle is eating his horrible pizza outside in the freezing cold, and the French guys are having this wondrous course of three-course meal and whatever, and it's a fancy restaurant in London, Midtown. And as I think there's a kind of parallel sequence between Jimmy McNulty and Idris Elba's character, where, again, he's like eating all this crap and whatever, and, you know, the Idris Elba character. I don't know, Stringerbell actually eats in some sort of she wrestler, but there's some sort of parallel to it, I remember thinking, blimey, that's straight out of the French Connection, really. So, yeah. And The Exorcist, of course, is the film, as he said, he will always be remembered for. Because it was, you know, even to this day, it's one of the all-time box office record films in the history of Hollywood, if you take it proportionally, you know, in terms of, you know, inflation and things like that as well. And, of course, also had the thing in this country, bizarrely, being banned as well by the BBFC for a long time. When it was all part of the Video Nasties thing as well. So bizarrely, if the only Exorcist you could get was Exorcist II, The Heretic, you know, the John Borman disastrous sequel. You know.
A far superior movie in my...
Now, I like Borman's films. I think there's some very interesting visual things in it.
Anything with Richard Burton in is going to get an immediate plus... For me,
well, it looked like Richard Burton was just reaching for his, you know, bottle of Courvoisier or vodka or God knows what he was on by that point. It was a bit like watching Richard Burton in Where Eagles Dare, and he's been doing all these amazing stunts, and he's like, you know, he's basically got the shakes for the whole film, as far as I can see, you know. But anyway, yeah, I mean, so, and obviously. I mean, again, you know, I think Mark Kermode was like a one-man industry and kind of reviving the whole thing about The Exorcist as well, you know, and has carried on ever since. It's certainly not my favourite film of all time, anyhow. But
no, again, I rewatched that. They released I'd never seen it on the big screen, so I saw it again in Venice this year, and I came out thinking it's a really good 4-star film. It's not for me.
Yeah, just... absolutely, it's an excellent film, but not a masterpiece. You know, I would say, you know, well, I would say the French Connection and Sorcerer are masterpieces. I mean, I think Friedkin made 3 masterpieces, which I'd also include To Live and Die in LA, which I saw actually with Friedkin talking about with Wang Chung on the stage and Mark Kermode about 4 or 5 years ago. And again, it's that difference of seeing a film is a cinematic thing, you know. The Exorcist, obviously, always insulated, I suppose, freaking, you know, because his films after that just did not make very much money, you know. But he was always able, I suppose, they were always able to say the director of The Exorcist or whatever, you know, and that kind of thing. Because he made a really rubbish horror film called The Guardian, I think. which is about a tree trying to take a child away, things like that, you know, which I've never seen. He did have quite a bad run in the late 80s, early 90s as well, you know.
Despite marrying the studio head.
Well, that was always he made a film called Jade that Joe Esterhaus wrote, and that was Joe Esterhaus's kind of thing, that he was Mr. Sherry Lansing, and that's the only reason he got the job. I mean, I'm not a great Joe Esterhaus fan, so it's not, you know, again, his, the best thing that he was involved in was Basic Instinct, and I think we'd say no more, really, you know.
So. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I tell you the truth, I think most of Joe Esterhaus's movies, you could go with Jagged Edge with Jeff Bridges, and then the template that he uses is almost reproduced in all his films. It's
apart from Showgirls.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Which is its own Paul Verhoeven nuttiness. So let's go to the second masterpiece. First of all, that title is awful.
Oh, it's appalling. Yeah, I mean, the thing was. He originally wanted, supposedly, I mean, whether this is true, he originally wanted to call it Ball Breaker. Now, I can't imagine any Hollywood, particularly one Hollywood show, let alone two, backing a film that cost $22 million at the time, which is an enormous sum at that time in the 70s, and wanting to distribute a film called Ball Breaker. Then he comes, obviously, there was some discussion whether I think it should be called The Wages of Fear again, which, of course, would have been directly on the notion, because he was always on the notion that he hadn't remade the film. This was a kind of new take upon the same kind of almost high concept. You know, it's a great concept, isn't it? You're driving nitroglycerin across a jungle to put out a fire, and you can be blown up at any time yourself. And a sorcerer, he says, you know, it was this notion that he'd done with faith in the exorcism. Now it was the sorcerer is the evil wizard of fate. And also then there was some argument he proclaimed that he got it from also a Miles Davis track as well. But it certainly did not help the film in any shape or form in terms of its first run. Because, the whole idea was his freaking made The Exorcist. What is this to an audience who are expecting an exorcist to themselves, you know, especially when it's called Sorcerer. So,
I mean, the thing about The Wages of Fear is that we tend to look at The Wages of Fear now. It's a 1950s, 1953. It's a black and white movie. It's in French. And so it's this sort of nailed on classic. But when Friedkin is making Sorcerer in 1977, it's only like 20 years afterwards. I mean, it's like somebody remaking The Matrix. I mean, it's not like...
I think you've got to bear in mind, because the reality now is you can download, you can stream everything, you can see everything continuously. So in our mind's eye, The Matrix, even though it is, you know, 25 years ago, essentially, is in people's consciousness in a way that popular music is in people's consciousness. What happened, I mean, after The Wages of Fear would have been shown in the 50s, that would have been it. Maybe it would have appeared on, I don't know, French television. I don't know. I'm not sure how the French movie system worked. And maybe it would have been shown at some revival houses. But, of course, once these films went out of circulation, and even big films, once they went out of circulation, maybe every so often they'd be revived. Like, you know, Disney used to do that, didn't they? And Bond films used to be shown. I remember seeing, like, a James Bond double bill of, you know, From Russia with Love and the later one Connery made, the last one, the one set in Las Vegas.
Diamonds Are Forever, yeah.
So these films may have only been like 20 or 25 years earlier, but they'd kind of gone out of the kind of public and critical consciousness as well. And there was a kind of critical lexicon idea that how dare freaking remake this classic, and particularly it's a French classic, is that, you know. Why, you know, as this upstart director think he's got the right to do this? In Andrew Sarris's review, this seemed to be the basic tenor of the review. And also, Friedkin hadn't helped himself, because he'd slagged off a lot of these critics as well, because when he was in his period of impotence, even though The Exorcist, you know, it had a mixed critical reception, let's put it that way. But he could say, well, I've made the most financially successful film up till Jaws. So, sodgy, basically. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of antipathy. And it was also seemed to be a thing which also Spielberg suffered from after, you know, you make two hits, two massive hits, and they're all out for you for the third film. And that happened to Spielberg as well with 1941, admittedly a gigantian, you know, situation as well. So it seemed to be something that, and of course those film critics at like Pauline Kael, Andrew Sarris, at that time, they could make or break a film. So, and I think there was hubris as well from Friedkin, you know, let's not kid ourselves, his behaviour when making Sorcerer was quite extraordinary as well. And there was sackings and firings of the line producer, David Salvin. Then there was a guy who was a CIC representative, Ian Lewis. So in the end, he gets the production credit as well as the directorial credit, where he didn't really produce Sorcerer. I mean, and also he was hiring and firing. I mean, he hired and fired. He got rid of his cameraman as well, Dick Bush, and he brought in his second unit guy, John Stevens. He probably did the ultimate crime. He'd upset the Teamsters as well. So, which is something you just don't do on big productions, particularly when you're, you know, and this film, it started off at 2.5 million. It's meant to be a small side production, and it escalates because, again, it's light apocalypse now and Aguirre, Rough and Good. When the directorial decision is taken to go make these films in the middle of the jungle, you've then got all the inherent problems of making a film in the middle of nowhere, getting film equipment over to the middle of nowhere, and also, obviously, the most famous sequence of Sorcerer is the famous rope bridge sequence, which took, you know, about 3 months to shoot, and it kept an escalator. They kept on finding rivers that were running out of water. And also there was some notion, this was the director of The Exorcist in the local village, then started going up in arms as well. So it had a kind of almost that kind of, if you've seen Burden of Dreams, and you know, Fitzcarraldo film, and also Darkness. And it would have been interesting if they had actually really had made a documentary of the making of Sorcerer at the time, but I think they were too busy doing actually making the film in the end. So, you know,
absolutely. So, I mean, the film as it stands, and as it stands now, as it exists in the DVD version that you can get now or the Blu-ray, has these, first of all, these stories, these prologues almost, which is essentially aren't that generically aren't that experimental. They're kind of like putting the team together, you know, but without anybody organizing it. It's just, how do all these different people get there? And so you've got like a Palestinian terrorist, you've got a French fraudster, and you've got an American sort of...
He's a getaway driver. Yeah. And you also got the hitman as well, the Francisco Rabal character as well, Nilo. Who I think they only add, though it's the first sequence that appears in the film, I think that was only added later. I looked at some earlier scripts, and that, there was no discussion of that between Friedkin and Green. Because, again, we have to give Waylon Green his credit as well, because the whole idea was also to structure us in a slightly different way. But, again, if you look at, you know, getting the French Connection and also Exorcist, you have these prologue sequences in both those films. You have the French cop being killed by the frog too. You have also Max von Sydow going out to the middle of Iran and finding that, you know, Pazuzu, although it wasn't called Pazuzu in that film. And actually, in some respects, that's the best sequence in the film of The Exorcist, I think, the opening 5-10 minutes of it, you know, because it has a general sense of mysticism and kind of actual kind of terror to it. Well, I mean, the actual exorcism themselves, I mean, it's obviously the unpleasant of what she does to herself with the crucifix and whatever. But most of it, once you've seen it, and once you've seen the green soup, and you know it's pea soup ultimately going over, you know, the priest and whatever, it doesn't quite have the shock effect, you know. But but going back to the Sorcerer, I mean, again, the whole idea was also, now I didn't think the guys in the original Wages of Fear were that kind of heroic. Particularly, you know, there's a criminal in that called Joe, who's the one who is the coward, ultimately. But the idea was to make them as unheroic as you could possibly do. So they are all criminals on the run. The Palestinian terrorist is presenting himself, as ironically enough, as an Israeli figure in the village. The fraudster has possibly the most poignant sequence with his wife. But then he's still trying to basically get his brother-in-law to divvy over the company. Then also, of course, the Roy Scheider character, he's kind of, no, he's, you know, he's quite the minor character in the actual, you know, the robbery of the mafioso church where they rob the bingo, isn't it? Because it's Gerald Murphy, who'd been an advisor and was one of Friedkin's somewhat interesting criminal consorts as well, who has the kind of main bit of that. He's got the leader of the gang. But then, you know, obviously the Scheider character survives the car crash and has to be on the run. So, yeah.
So we have these guys from these disparate areas, and they're arriving in the middle of a sort of fictional South American, Latin American country. It's something I never like. It's like the fictional African country. Just pick a country and do some research. nobody would do that with Europe. I mean, unless it's the mouse that roared, nobody would say, in a fictional European country.
Yeah, true. I mean, I think originally it was going to be, I can't remember if it was Bolivia or Peru. They all reckon that if they shot it out there, Friedkin would have been killed. And Wasserman basically said, you'll be killed in more. Importantly, we won't get any insurance on you. So, and then, of course, this is where Bluthorn came in terms of the production side, because he owned the Dominican Republic. That's where it was predominantly shot. This had been used once before for the Cuban sequences in The Godfather Part 2. They'd shot in Santo Domingo. Bluthorn had grand plans to turn Dominican Republic into some sort of Disney world of, and how it was going to have Miss World beauty pageants and God knows whatever there. But it kind of came to a cropper after Sorcerer didn't do very well. But so that's where it was shot ultimately. And John Box actually was the production designer, who was David Lean's production designer. And he and his art crew did an extraordinary job of turning what was a completely horrible shantytown into an even worse one, apparently.
Yeah, he's one of the unsung heroes of the film, which you're singing, actually. You're singing his praises.
Yeah, I mean, John Box, was a magnificent production designer, obviously, Dr. Zhivago and Lawrence of Arabia, and lots of other kind of epic productions as well. So that they and again, we have to give him his credit for actually coming up with the trucks as well, which have these extraordinary kind of monstrous kind of look about them as well. I mean, they're not like the truck. I mean, that is the big difference between the Wages of Fear, in the original film. The trucks in the original film are quite glossy and new, and even the nitroglycerin quite nice stacked kind of, you know, things. This is like nitroglycerin held in sand every time they move. And also the roads are just appallingly terrible as well, you know. So, and also you think the suspension of the trucks and everything like this must be just absolutely atrocious, you know. Because and again, you have that big, again, freaking putting things together sequence where the four of them, and with the Nazi, of course, then gets killed by Nilo, have put all the trucks together and they get various bits and they turn and it's done with the Tangerine Dream music. And it's one of those kind of sequence where obviously he enjoyed himself editing this together and putting it together. You know, you can see that that was the kind of thing that he loved to do in films as well, freaking. So, yeah.
And as the film goes on, and as we go through the journey, and we have the blowing up of the tree, and we have the famous bridge sequence, which really should be even more famous, because it really should go down as one of the, it should be neck and neck with the French Connection's car chases, the most tense.
It's incredibly tense, and also it's one of those things that's it seems to defy all kind of physical logic. I mean, the trucks did fall off in reality, and Friedkin claimed that he was in one of them as well. Because this thing took so long to film, and they had to, again, this is the whole idea of where the money goes, because they have to create a false storm. They then have to dam the rivers about 2 miles up so they can actually get enough of a flow going through. So it looks like a tremendous flow is going through because the rivers kept them drying out. And also, again, they had to actually kind of put in pre-CGI, they had to kind of utilize a number of techniques to actually put the rain against the windows and things like that. So again, what appears to be all just shot is all made up of incredible component parts to it. And of course, the blowing up of the tree was also, this is where, again, the story is that it's Friedkin claimed in his, you know, the Friedkin Connection, that this is where Charles Bluthorn shows up in a helicopter and they're filming this, and he's his guy who's put the dynamite in Marshall Fateur, I think his name is, who was his special effects guy in The Exorcist, simply doesn't put enough in and don't blow up the tree. And this is the very point, of course, that Gluthorn is extolling the virtues of what a great genius Friedkin is and things like that. And of course, as soon as he sees this, he's straight back in a helicopter with his girlfriend or whatever and his underling, and straight out there. And then Friedkin has to get this guy who's known as an arsonist, who shows up with a variety of beauty products, as he's described, and he's able to blow up the tree, you know. And that's, again, so. And there's lots of problems also in the car crash as well.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
New Jersey. Again, they were shot on the East Coast. They couldn't get the stunt people who could do that. So they're going to have to get stunt people in from Los Angeles, which the then line producer, David Salvin, said, I've had enough of this. I can't deal with this any longer. So he gets fired. I mean, he gets rehired on other films by Friedkin. So there doesn't seem to be a long-standing problem with it. But again, it's that situation. I suppose he's now in a situation of omnipotence. He can be the ultimate perfectionist director, you know.
Yeah.
And unlike Coppola, who's spending his own money, he's spending someone else's. So he's clever enough in that respect as well, you know.
Absolutely. And he also has this, you know, he has this relationship with the actors, which is extreme to some degree. I mean, I sometimes think as well, he sort of tends to use no-name actors, although Roy Scheider was famous at this point for Jaws. But Jaws is a film that, you know, Roy Scheider might be famous in it, but everyone went for the shark. No one went to see.
Yeah, of course. But again, Scheider wasn't his first choice. He wanted Steve McQueen. And I spoke to Nat Segeloff, and he said, I said, what would have happened if Steve McQueen had been? He said, well, it would have become a Steve McQueen film rather than a ruling Friedkin one. So Friedkin almost said he regretted, because this whole idea of making the film in the middle of nowhere in the jungle, I mean, McQueen didn't want to do that. I mean, McQueen was now, happy, wealthy, well, not very happy, but a very wealthy man who just didn't want to go and do that. So he said, right, well, can we not make it in California? Friedkin goes, no. And then he goes, well, if we do make it, I can't leave the country because I've just been married to Ally McGraw, who he met on The Getaway, the Sam Peckinpah film. And, again, he said, can you give her a part or an associate production credit? And Friedkin says, that's a bullshit situation. I'm not having it. And then subsequently says, I realise actually a close-up of Steve McQueen would have been much better than miles of, you know, acres of rainforest. But he'd made his... But then it wasn't going straight to Scheider. I mean, Clint Eastwood apparently was approached, Jack Nicholson, even Robert Mitchum. And Robert Mitchum said, well, I can fall out of a car in front of my drive. Why would I want to do it in the Dominican Republic or whatever? And Robert Blake was another one he was talked about, which Tarantino kind of bigged up in a documentary about Friedkin and said they would have been much better. I don't think Robert Blake would have been any good at all, but anyway, that's my take on it. And then Scheider was eventually picked out by Sheinberg. And, because, as you say, Jaws had just come about, really. And because the thing was also this... He had this, it was the first, I suppose, as you say, he liked Unknown certainly in The Exorcist and also in French Connection. But he wanted to have this spectacular international cast for this film. So it wouldn't have been just McQueen. It would have been Lino Ventura would have played the fraudster rather than Bruno Kramer. And Marcellino Marcellini, well, you know, I've said it wrong, Mastriani would have played the hitman. You know? Always the guy, Amadou was always going to play the terrorist. But then, of course, Ventura, Mastriani. Well, Mastriani had a problem with Catherine Deneuve at the time because he just had a kid by and he had problems like that. But also Ventura said, I'm not going to be second fiddle to Roy Scheider. So, you know, so that was the end of his dream cast, basically. So,
yeah, I mean, but at the same time, it kind of works because...
Oh, yeah, much better, yeah.
You're not distracted by anybody, and Roy Scheider has that face which is perfect for 1970s cinema. It's just like that broken nose and that, you know...
Yeah. Obviously, the character is very specifically modelled on Fred C. Dobbs from The Treasure of Sierra Madre. And again, he has that ability to wear a hat like Bogart could do as well. So, I mean, Scheider, I think, is very good in it. I mean, and he was a very good actor stroke leading man, but he never quite got his due, did he? He said with Jaws, obviously, but he was in other films. Obviously, it was the Bob Fosse film, all that jazz.
It's film.
But, he supposed he was going to be the lead in The Deer Hunter. I couldn't quite see how that would have worked myself, but... And then he owed Universal another film, which ended up being Jaws 2, which he hated, but obviously made a huge ton of money. So, you know. And then after that, he seemed to kind of just not exactly disappear, but because he did make a decent John Frankenheim called 52 Pickup. But he never really seemed to have the credit that he should have done, really. I mean, he's one of the few people who worked again with Friedkin as well. But in this respect, quite unhappily, because apparently he wanted to play the lead priest in The Exorcist. Friedkin said no, and he took exception. But Friedkin said it wasn't me. William Peter Blatty didn't want you or something like that. But Scheider never quite believed him, I think, you know.
Yeah, I mean, he disappears for so long that it seems like he's really come back when he comes back in The Naked Gun. It's like, oh, this guy's still around. You know, I mean, and he did a lot of television work. I think he did that sort of Star Trek Under the Sea.
Did he? Oh, yes, he did. You're right. Yeah. I mean, he made a film called Blue Thunder as well, where John Badham made about a helicopter.
You know, pre-Airwolf.
Yeah, and it had the usual preening Malcolm McDowell as the kind of sneering British villain in it, who is almost coming so much out of the kind of stock kind of, you know, he's obviously camp as well and whatever against Roy Scheider's hero kind of figure, you know. But I mean, and then the whole cast in terms of the leads, I think is very good. You know, I mean, Amadou was very good as the terrorist. I mean, the only one I suppose who doesn't get much of a role is the hitman, Francesco Labrabel, who, ironically enough, going back to the French Connection, was the one he wanted for Alan Charnier, supposedly, rather than Fernando Rey. I'm never entirely sure that's an apocryphal tale from Friedkin. It's a good story that his casting director got the wrong guy from the Buñuel films and things like that. But, you know, I never quite believe that, you know.
Friedkin, who fires the entire crew of his film, I think would have absolutely no worries about saying, you go back, I'm getting the right guy.
Maybe more on French Connection because they were running against a very tight budget. But I mean, I still don't quite believe that he didn't want Gene Hackman and things like that. You know, I think that's a great story. And Gene Hackman was his fifth choice or whatever. And of course, also out of French Connection, a number of his other kind of characters, you know, Randy Jurgensen is in Sorcerer as well in a very small role and was one of the kind of technical security advisors on it as well, you know, who later on would obviously be involved very significantly in Cruising as well.
There is this legend that we've already nodded to in terms of the Biskindai thesis, which also doesn't really work after the 1990s because Scorsese's career just goes from strength. Terrence Malick comes back with A Thin Red Line and proves he can make a big studio movie. As if
I think you're more of a Malick fan than I am, John. I thought The Thin Red Line could have had a good hour cut out of it, but anyway, it's just me. So.
We shall utterly disagree on that. But even these big failures, like Cruising has been, as you said, yeah, I mean, I have a lot of time for Cruising. I think it's a great thriller, a really, really interesting film. And as you said, to live and die in LA is now you yourself regard it as a masterpiece.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not actually that bad a career.
No, it's not. I mean, you've got to remember though, he after Soul Surrey, he doesn't go straight into cruising. He makes another film called The Brinks Job with Peter Falk. Which everybody forgets about, but it says he actually inherited that. Well, he inherited that from Frankenheimer, ironically enough. After Frankenheimer made that point and made French Connection too. Then he makes Cruising, which is, I mean, now it's considered, I think, something of a kind of underground classic. I wouldn't say a masterpiece, but an underground classic. It's, he has big problems with Pacino. He and Pacino distinctly hate each other. Pacino won't do any publicity for it either. And it's a, to me, Cruising is a slightly botched narrative, though, because he suddenly had this idea that the leather bar killer was about 10 different people by the end of it, you know. But anyway, and then he makes this extraordinarily awful comedy called Deal of the Century with Chevy Chase, which he made again for Norman Lear and Bud Yorkin, who he must have had some linkage for going back to the Minsky, the night they raided Minsky's film. And then independently makes what we talked about, To Live and Die in LA, which is a very small budgeted film with, again, complete unknowns at the time. You know, William Peterson and William Friedkin, William Dafoe were not well-known people, you know. And William Dafoe had a little bit of a career, being in a couple of sort of minor sort of like biker films and things like that, but was a New York stage actor. In the same way that Peterson had been, again, a Chicagoan stage actor as well, a Shakespearean actor. And then he makes another film called Rampage, which I remember seeing and thought was actually quite good. But again, it all gets cut and mucked up when distribution issues and Dino De Laurentiis' production company collapsing as well. So, and he tried also to make a TV series, which is kind of a strange thing called Cat's Eyes, which I don't know if you've ever heard or seen.
Is it like Stephen King?
No, it was meant to be, it was not, again, maybe the title didn't help it either, because it's meant to be like some sort of police enforcer agency, kind of in on an international scale or something like that.
Right, like an Interpol.
Bizarrely enough, it's actually the music in Cat's Eyes and Rampage are done by Ennio Morricone. Which is, I mean, and actually, if you listen to the Cat's Eyes, and maybe it's just me, but I listened to this and I was thinking, that's the music he was using in The Untouchables. So that's why he can plagiarise himself, can't he? So, you know, well, why not, basically? So, but again, this is part of the thing about the book was actually not just thinking, I mean, obviously there's looking at the thematics of, obviously, the film. There's also some of this kind of magical realism thing that he kind of sticks in there as well. But it was also to think about, well, what did this show about these people's careers? And what you've got to give Friedkin his due for, unlike Cimino, who went off and kind of disappeared in some sort of glorious Swanson, you know, kind of disappearing into the Hollywood Hills. I know he made a few other films, but Friedkin kept at it. You know, that's what Nat Segeloff said to me, that he could have just like, he'd had enough money, he could have just thrown in the towel. But he would, even, you know, obviously up to, you know, just before dying, having making the, you know, this version of the Caine Mutiny, you know, he did keep at it, you know, so.
Which is very good, which I saw and is excellent.
Is it good, is it? Right.
Yeah.
I'm going to have a look at it because it's on, I think you can now stream it, can't you? So,
It's brilliantly acted. It's a very minimalist. It's very much going back to a sort of film drama. The original play, Jason Clarke is
the kind of Jose Ferrer character, isn't
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And Kiefer Sutherland is the Captain Queeg.
Yeah.
Really good. Really well done.
Well, he did. You know? Well, I mean, that was the other interesting kind of parallel career Friedkin always had. When we were talking about The Birthday Party, obviously there's boys in the band. He then obviously, you know, has this extraordinary, as people say, comeback with the Bug film that he made. 2005 or 2006 with Michael Shannon and I can't remember the actress's name.
Ashley Judd.
Ashley Judd, that's right. And then I thought Killer Joe was good as well. You know, quite sick, but it was certainly. I mean, he did try some big action budget ones as well. I mean, And of course, he did a very good version with Jack Lemmon and George C. Scott, 12 Angry Men for TV, which has people even like, he has William Peterson, James Gandolfini, and people like that in it as well. You know, I mean, he made, obviously, he made some of these sort of duff ones like Jade, and I never saw Blue Chips was in his basket. I know he loved basketball, but it was, I never, that was Nick Nolte. And his other one, the Guardian or whatever, with the tree taking the child away. And then he got some big budget films in the sort of early, in early noughties. He got Rules of Engagement with Samuel L. Jackson and Tommy Lee Jones,
which was
really, wasn't very good. I mean, he made some money. He got freaking again a bit more financial clout. Then he made, I've never seen it, Tommy Jones and Benicio del Toro, kind of a version, a kind of version of Rambo, I think. I can't remember what that one was called, actually.
It's called The Hunted.
That's right, yeah.
It's called The Hunted.
Is that any good? Have you seen it?
Yeah, I've seen it. It's really good. It's basically like an unofficial sequel of The Fugitive, because Tommy Lee Jones is very much playing the same sort of character. Okay, we've got a, I want a perimeter of 20, you know, and yeah, and he, and they go out, and then it becomes a sort of survival combat between these two guys. And I very much rate it. It's a very well done. There's nothing in it that you would particularly go, this is William Friedkin, if I didn't know it, but it's a real quality piece of sort of action and adventure filmmaking, which, you know. And he also directed a lot of operas in this period.
Oh, that's right. No, you'll come to. I mean, again, I'm looking really at the film situation, but that's right. He became a kind of polymath in that respect, you know. And also, as you say, became an incredible raconteur. I mean, you can find loads of things in online. And I mean, I'd say I only saw him. I did try and interview him, but I could only. Nat Segeloff, who's very, who wrote the biography for him, was very helpful, and I interviewed him. And also a guy called a scriptwriter called Josh Olson. And Josh Olson had been very much involved in the kind of resurrection of Sorcerer. Because he'd been part of the program of a kind of freaking series in Los Angeles, again, kind of, you know, retro cinema. And what they'd done wisely was to show The Exorcist and Sorcerer. But I think what they did was they showed Sorcerer first, and so the crowd had to stick around to watch The Exorcist. So they said if they'd done The Exorcist, nobody would stick around with Sorcerer. And suddenly all these people were saying, my God, this is a brilliant film. Why has this not been... And it got this, obviously online as well, it got this kind of subsequent, you know, kind of life to it as well, where lots of people said, this is a brilliant film, why was it treated like this shabbily? Now, the easy story is Star Wars, of course. But I think the other story is that, you know, there was a bit like what happened with Coppola, when Coppola tried to do the whole zoetrope thing in the early 80s, there was a deliberate, dare I say, pincer movement by the powers that be in Hollywood to put these people in their place as well, which is the counter narrative that Biskin doesn't really talk about, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with that. I think there was, the Star Wars narrative is a little bit too neat. I think it's, also there's the irony that, as you say in your book, he was initially making Sorcerer as his low budget sort of personal conversation. And his next big budget film was supposed to be a science fiction.
That's right. It's going to be a Close Encounters star film about the Bermuda Triangle. That was what he was focusing and focused on. And then Spielberg came out, and of course, he saw Close Encounters and said, oh God, he's used part of my plot in that, you know. So but there's also another great irony, of course, when he and Coppola and Bogdanovich had his very short-lived director's company, which Friedkin never made a film for, but did enjoy some of the production benefits about the monies that came in from the other one at Paper Moon. That Coppola brought Lucas along, and Lucas said, I've got this new idea called the Star Wars at the time. And both Friedkin and Bogdanovich threw it as and said, what's this rubbish? What are they talking about? You know, talking robots and God knows whatever, you know. And I just didn't get it. You know, and that's the other thing with Star Wars. When I was a kid, I saw it. And the first Star Wars was like a magical experience. Because, you know, I mean, then it became, you had to write backstories and Darth Vader suddenly becomes Anakin Skywalker and all that sort of stuff. But, and Lucas also, you know, again, he's forgotten about. He was, again, one of these kind of independent spirits. I mean, he and Coppola set up Zoetrope in the late 60s. They didn't want to be part of the Hollywood machine, as it were, as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I think if you listen to especially some of his more recent interviews, because I think he's become someone who's more comfortable in speaking in public than he used to be. There's a brilliant Christopher Nolan interview that he does when Nolan's interviewing him essentially, and he talks about how he worked Star Wars out economically, that we're not going to have any costume changes, and that'll save money, and we're not going to, and we, you know. Initially, the idea of shooting it in England was about saving money, and you know.
Oh yeah, I mean, no, it's exactly. Lucas was always the story that Coppola was American, Lucas was Japan, wasn't it? That was always meant to be. A Coppola would go out, you know, throw himself. He'd the kind of guy throw himself off the cliff and see what happens, and George Lucas go, hold on here, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, again, Coppola and Friedkin were big pals. And again, John Milius famously said there became this thing about to become a director in the late 70s, you had to go to somewhere completely remote. You had to basically play with your own sanity and your own health. And this moved away from the old kind of director with the kind of horsewhip and the, you know, the megaphone, into the kind of the director who throw everything on the line and see how it, what, you know, where it went, you know. And there became obviously a rivalry of, I mean, I'd include John Boorman with that actually, because when Boorman went off and made Hell in the Pacific, they made it the most remote island they could possibly find, you know, and also Deliverance as well. So that was the famous story that John Voight said, did you save my life by casting me? Then you spent 6 weeks trying to kill me, you know. So, and it became that thing that, you know, again, you had to make these things, and like Herzog as well, and you had to, you know, the idea of putting a boat over a mountain, you know, which I didn't do in reality, but this became part of the directorial vision, you know, which was always being conjured up, you know. So I mean, it's an interesting time in filmmaking, you know, you can't deny that, you know.
Yeah, and it's kind of like one of those things that, it's probably nicer to look back on than it was to experience.
Oh, dreadful. I mean, the people who had to work with these, I mean, but the interesting thing, I mean, I know I was able to put it in the book, but I went to the library where Friedkin's papers are, and I was very much helped by the librarians and also by Nat Segeloff. What you notice is also they cost everything for these mega productions. So even to the tiniest kind of thing, each week there had to be a kind of a budgeting report that presumably went back to the studios and whatever. And again, you know, the costs would escalate and escalate and escalate. There's the big story, but there's all these tiny little things that are put into a big and budgeted film, you know. So, which is interesting because it just demonstrates how bottom line there is also in this situation, you know. You know, I mean, Friedkin had his very loyal people. I mean, again, I was reading some of the letters. There was Barry Bedick, who was his property master, said, you're the real deal. And so by this point, he was working on the Dustin Hoffman film, which is a good film about him being the criminal in Los Angeles. It was based on the book No Beast So Fierce. I can't remember what he was called. But he said, you know, the director was Ulu Grossberg. He said, this guy's got not a clue. And also, Hoffman is just like ruling the roost, basically.
Oh, was it? Was it? Because Hoffman ended up getting a directorial credit for that, I think.
He was going to direct it, then at the last moment he ducked out.
Right.
It's got Harry Dean Stanton and Gary Busey. Nicholas Rogue's wife. I can't remember. I just can't remember what the film's called now.
Teresa Russell.
Yeah, she's in it. Yeah.
Yeah. Is it called something like Short Time or something like that?
It might be. Yeah. I think it's something. It's something time, but I don't know. Anyway, it was one of the ones that Tarantino subsequently beefed up as being one of his influential.
Straight Time. I think there's a thing post Tarantino as well that we love 70s cinema so much that it's almost we're willing to we just want to live in that world where cars are real and telephones are heavy.
I mean, it's also, I mean, I agree with you, but I mean, again, in some research, I'm kind of now bigging up the Biskin thesis, because Polly Platt, who was Doug Bogdanovich's ex-wife, you know, the woman that he left Sybil Shepherd for, she also said, you know, these directors went mad. I mean, you know, Peckinpah was coke fiend and, you know, alcoholic, and was blowing a budget on Convoy. It was going out of fashion. Altman was like, again, he was making all sorts of crazy films. He ended up making that, you know, Robin Williams playing Popeye and things like that. And you obviously, I mean, let's not kid ourselves, drugs did, in, even on the Sorcerer set, there was, I don't think Friedkin was ever part of it, but there were certainly members of the crew who were largely imbibing as well. And certainly it happened, it's never really talked about in Apocalypse Now, but my God, it must have happened out there.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you're kidding. Martin Sheen had an almost fatal heart attack, and he was an alcoholic.
He was an alcoholic, wasn't he? I mean, he said on the opening sequence, they got him completely drunk, and then he said he remembered everything, however. And he was smoking, you know, at that point, about 40 cigarettes a day and things like that. Yeah, I mean, again, Coppola, I mean, obviously, like Friedkin, they both did become megalomaniacs, I think. I don't think you can deny that. And they were the kings of their domain, as it were, as well. And this was the whole thing, that you went off and made these films in the middle of nowhere, so who's going to oversee you? So, because the studio, I mean, this, as I said, the difference was that Coppola was using his own money. And it looks like he's going to do it again with Megapolis. Friedkin was always clever enough to use someone else's. It's in the book. There's this, you know, long letter that came from Jules Stein, because Jules Stein had been his backer at Universal, as I said, over Wasserman and Scheinberg. And Friedkin said, "Hands up, I've made a cock up here." And Stein writes back, said, "That's very good of you to take the blame and whatever. But remember, you lost us an enormous amount of money." And there is this situation that we have to be aware of. You know, that they are making commercial enterprises as well as great art house, not like I say art house films, but you know what I mean, but also films that have a greater validity as well beyond just a commercial outcome, you know. So,
But I mean, I would argue that the great films of the 70s, with some exception, are all very much in the popular generic wheelhouse, you know, Exorcist, Godfather, French Connection, Sorcerer. Sorcerer is an adventure in the jungle,
No, it's an action adventure film. I mean, it's. But there were a lot of other kind of, it was your Monty Hellman kind of character, you know, the two-lane blacktop, and there was also a very good film with Gene Hackman and Pacino called Scarecrow, Jerry Schatzberg, I think, made as well. So they were prepared to make uncommercial fare as well. And also The Conversation was not, it didn't break any lines at the box office, but then, of course, he went off and made Godfather Part Two. So he was like, and that was one of the problems that Friedkin had going back to the director's company. He said, "We're going to make esoteric films that no one's going to want to watch." And he wasn't alone in, because Frank Yablins, this was Charlie Bludhun's idea with Coppola, they conjured it up. Frank Yablins, the other executive, along with Robert Evans, said, "This is just going to be directors, you know, not being out of control, basically, you know, so, and making films that no one wants to see." So,
yeah, but the Conversation was relatively low budget. I mean, it wasn't like
I mean, that was the whole idea of the director's company. They had to be, I think, at most $2 million. I mean, Bogdanovich said it was a brilliant idea, but then he went off and made Daisy Miller under the director's, and that finished it off, really, you know.
Yeah, you have to do a Blumhouse and you have to stick to it. But I mean, that is the economic model of Blumhouse. Here's a few million, and keep it below the budget, and you can do what you want. And it's got to be horror. And
well, there's also the UA model as well, of course. I mean, United Artists with Krim and Benjamin and David Picker, that was their thing. If you made they give you the budget and they did give you creative independence for both the producers and the director. I mean, it happened in Midnight Cowboy particularly. So you have a number of those kind of films. I mean, and United Artists was the home of like Woody Allen and the home of a number of other kind of what could be creative directors of the era. There's so many areas. I mean, Coppola makes The Godfather because he has to financially. Because, you know, the original Zoetrope, he's blown the deal with Warner Brothers because of THX-1138. And George Lucas basically says, "You're going to have to make this, otherwise we're going to go bankrupt," you know, because Warner Brothers want their pound of flesh, you know. And so, again, there's always... And again, there's people who work with each other. People, it's that whole, you know, that Hollywood is a relatively small place, isn't it? And so there's always these kind of interlinkages that you start seeing, you know, take place amongst people as well.
Listen, Mark, I've got one last question for you, which is, as ever, I always ask for a recommended film book. What book would you like to recommend?
Well, I've got two, because come back to The Godfather, I've actually been writing about a thing called The Godfather Doctrine, which is an international relations foreign policy parable based on the plot of The Godfather, the first one. And it tries to relate the idea of American foreign policy to the breaking down of Pax Corleone and having the three sons having different responses, the negotiation with Dom Hagen, the going at neocon idea with Sonny, and then what's called realism, the idea of using hard and soft power by Michael. So, it's quite a neat little idea. I mean, it falls apart very specifically, but anyway. And the other one is an interesting book. Again, it's quite pressing at the time. It's a book called Hollywood and Israel, which is written by two academics, Tony Shaw and Israeli academic Gora Goodman. And again, it's a very fascinating history, because the people you'd assume it's largely Jewish people who could be Zionists, but no, it's like people like Frank Sinatra, things like that. And then it also goes through the kind of relative productions of Exodus, the old Otto Preminger film, which of course was made in Israel, you know, ironically enough, casting Paul Newman as the kind of Jewish superhero. And then also more read up today goes Spielberg with the Munich film as well. So I think they're both, I know they're academic books, but they're kind of interesting reads. The more popular one I would recommend is Dwight Epstein's Killing Generals about the making of Dirty Dozen, which I did enjoy. I don't know if you've come across it. It's like a sequel to his Lee Marvin biography, but it is enjoyable. And he's able to interview the director, not the director, because he's dead, to Robert Aldridge, but the producer, Kenneth Hyman, who's still alive, who had an interesting, you know, he made The Hill with Sean Connery. He'd done a load of Hammer films as well. And Who's Afraid of... Who's Afraid of Virginia, the other one, Baby Jane. He was the executive producer on that.
Right.
And then later on, with another Aldridge, and he later on then became the production. He was part of Seven Arts, and they bought up Warners from Jack Warner. And it was an interesting period of time, because, again, you had Coppola at Seven Arts, who became like their house writer for a period of time. And then he also had Peckinpah making The Wild Bunch there. And Hyman was his big kind of supporter, because that was like Peckinpah's comeback film after the debacle of Major Dundee and Cincinnati Kid. But it's very interesting about Lee Marvin, Robert Ryan, you know, those kind of people, and John Cassavetes and that kind of stuff as well. So
just recently watched the Exodus for the first time. It was in September, so it was before everything sort of kicked off recently, and it is a weird film, because I just mean it kind of is justifying Israeli terrorism, the blowing up of the King David Hotel, in a way which is kind of like, I just wonder what British audiences would have made of it.
That's part of the compromises. I mean, again, reading this book, this was what the original book by Leon Uris was, a complete, you know, Zionist propaganda book, apparently. I've never read it. But when they came to make the film, this was Otto Preminger he fell out of years, he fell out of everybody. And he got Dalton Trumbo to write it, who of course was better, you know, it's a part of the Hollywood 10, and was better known for, you know, being involved with Spartacus at the time. And subsequent histories have always ignored the fact that Exodus, I think, came out before Spartacus. I can't fully remember. But anyway, and the whole thing was that they had to do loads of compromises, as you say, because I don't know how British audiences did take it, because they were very mindful there was a big market in Britain for, you know, big blockbuster films. And, you know, the Brits are the baddies in certainly the Cyprus sequences, and presumably the Ergun are the good guys, you know, although the main character is meant to be part of the Hazanak, aren't they? And again, in the light of where we are now, this is what tends to be forgotten in these histories. You know, again, it's a bit like the Munich film about what does violence beget violence, and also who are the terrorists? You know, this is the, you know, and that's what Spielberg got slagged off for with his Tony Kushner as well, by you got a hardline Zionist as well, particularly in America. So when he made that film, but it's again very interesting because there was actual direct state involvement in the making of the book and the film. You know, because it wasn't just a good kind of propaganda thing. We have to bear in mind, actually, it brought in a lot of money, not just in terms of box office, but actually having a huge American production in Israel was, and lots of Israeli people, technicians, all these kind of people worked on it as well. So, because again, I think there were kind of quota right rules and things like that, you know. So, Preminger ever liked him. He was not a likable man. I mean, he was talking about, we were talking about the kind of stereotypical 70s directors like Friedkin and, you know, Coppola doing him going off to the middle of the jungle. Also, Preminger, a lot of Eric von Stroheim is like your quintessential kind of autocratic director of that classic Hollywood era, isn't it?
Oh, he was a guy with a whip.
Yeah, oh no, he was and of course he played the Nazi commandant in the Billy Wilder film, didn't he? Stalag 17 as well.
Well, listen, Mark, thanks so much for the conversation, and thanks so much for the book. Sorcerer is it's a great read, and I think if people have seen the film, it will be a great compliment to that. And if they haven't, it'll be a great stimulant to going and watching it.
Well, thanks very much, John, for inviting me. So thank you very much.
So that was my conversation with Mark. I really enjoyed getting in depth about the craziness of that shoot and the career of William Friedkin, and wider look at the career of one of cinema's great geniuses, I guess. Certainly a rocky career, but one which created masterpieces. There's no doubt about it. And there are some filmmakers who have much larger filmographies, much more commercially successful films, who never make a masterpiece. And Friedkin arguably made at least three, I think was our final count. But there's arguments that go a little higher, arguments that go a little lower. That'd be interesting to hear your opinions if you want to get in touch. By the way, you can get in touch with the podcast by just DMing me on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, or leaving comments, and I'll read them and I can put them in this post conversation segment. This week I've had an interesting sort of watch of films, mostly old films, nothing particularly new. Our first one was John Cassavetes' Gloria, which is from 1980 and stars Gina Rowlands, his wife, as a functionary of the mafia, a hit woman, who throws in her lot with a young boy of a neighbour who basically everyone is seeking to kill. And she decides to protect, thus putting her whole life and way of living in jeopardy. It's an amazing film. I don't know how this has gone under the radar for me, because I'm a huge fan of John Cassavetes. And this in many ways brings together Cassavetes' philosophy of filmmaking with a much more commercial and accessible genre approach. And it's just, it's fascinating. It's amazing. And Gina Rowlands has a wonderful performance. Is marvelous. It's just totally a character that she disappears into. You know, there's everything about her behavior and actions, her gestures, the way she speaks, the way she spits out the lines, just something you've never seen before. Just an absolutely unique character, and well worth your time if you haven't seen it. I thoroughly recommend it. It's gone down as one of my favourites of this year, favourite discoveries of this year. I've also been having a bit of a Studio Ghibli moment. I watched Whisper of the Heart from up on Poppy Hill, Porco Rosso, Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, all of which I found amazing. I think Porco Rosso and Nausicaa probably my favorite, the Miyazaki films. Of course, it's difficult to beat Miyazaki. I rewatched Jackie Brown, having read a lot of Elmore Leonard. I haven't yet read Rum Punch, which is the novel which Jackie Brown is based on. This is a film that always feels like the hipster's Tarantino, the one that allows them to like Tarantino without being too obvious or dumb or film bro-y. Far be it from me to, you know, suggest the other reasons for people to like a film other than they just simply like it. But it is an odd film. I mean, I can't say I wholeheartedly love it. It's got some great bits in it. But it feels like it's a film that is overly restrained. It actually feels much more like a TV episode. It feels like this is Tarantino doing a TV movie. You know, it's restrained in terms of its locations, in terms of its the way it's going about its storylines. I mean, it feels like an episode of Columbo or something like that. You know, it's a good episode of Columbo. It's a good episode of it's a good version of Elmore Leonard, but I don't think it's as good as Steven Soderbergh's Out of Sight, for instance. I'm not even sure it captures Elmore Leonard in quite the same way that Get Shorty, the Baron Sonnenfeld film, does. It is, of course, bolstered by five amazing performances. I'm going to leave Michael Keaton out of that. I don't think he's particularly good, or he's particularly a major character. He just doesn't seem to have much to do as the FBI agent. Whereas Robert De Niro, Samuel L. Jackson, Bridget Fonda, Pam Grier, and Robert Foster, probably in reverse order, are really doing something interesting, and they're really eating up screen. Samuel L. Jackson, sort of on rewatch, feels like he's a more dominant presence than any actor in the film, and he seems to be the one who's having the most fun, whereas everybody else just seems to be sort of underplaying it. I did like Robert De Niro in this as well. I thought De Niro has again, he felt on first viewing like I was watching Michael Keaton, that he was just happy to be in a Tarantino film, which is a crazy thing to say, because De Niro here is at the height of his career, and he's, you know, he's able to play anything. But on rewatch, in the context of this not being the latest Quentin Tarantino, but one that's well back in his back catalogue, I feels like a B-side to me. Feels like a B-side, but a really good B-side. And I can understand why loads of people discover this and say this is their favorite Tarantino and all the rest of it, to impress the kids or not. Another film that I watched, which is relatively new, is Passages, the Ira Sachs film from this year. So this was the most recent film. And it stars Franz Rogowski, Ben Whishaw, and Adele Exarchopoulos as a love triangle, a menage a trois. Even though it's set in France, most of the language in the film is English. There's a bit of French in there, but it's mostly English. And Franz Rogowski is a selfish and petulant film director who is in a relationship with Ben Whishaw and then has an affair with Adele Exarchopoulos. And they're basically, in his wish to have everything, kind of ruins everybody's lives, including his own. It's a melodrama, but it's a well-made melodrama. It's slick, it's well done, and the quality of the performances lift it way above perhaps where it deserves to be. So it makes for a great film. I don't know if it quite scales the heights that its ambition seems to require, but it's really well worth a watch if you haven't seen it. It's superior entertainment, let's say. Okay, those are the films I've been watching recently. Next week, I don't know what we have, so there might be a brief hiatus. I'll be away in Tallinn, so I might well be doing a report live from Estonia. And if I do, then that will be the next episode. Okay, until then, take care. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.